Let's begin with the invocation of Sufi Inayat Khan. Palms up in both supplication and in, we could say submission, but we could also say ready to receive, willingly receiving the blessings that stream from above and all around us. So our hands become cups, chalices to receive this blessing. And we say,
towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls, who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance.
Feel the fullness and bounty of that blessing and use it to bathe over, wash through you and over you. So before the class formally began, I asked people in the room that are with us, and as well as those that are on the online with us, if they had this book or seen it, A Year with Hafiz. Lahir Roman Horst introduced me to this at camp, and I thought, oh my goodness, I love the translations. The translations are by Daniel Ladinsky. Those that are entering the call, if you would mute your microphone in the lower left corner so we don't hear background noise. When you wish to engage, you can unmute it. This is for today, June 15th, and it says, pray to your hand. The foundation for insanity is laid, and every moment it increases as the universe expands. The foundation for insanity is laid, and every moment it increases as the universe expands. Too convincing for most everyone is form. And we're going to have someone entering the room, so there's going to probably be some barking from our dog. So just that too is part of it. Too convincing. Joe, we might need another chair for this. See, there's two people. If you want to get it from the kitchen. Yeah, we're just gonna... I'm going to wait so we can do the camera. Thank you. The one we already began with, the invocation, and we're reading from this book, A Year with Hafiz. And this is from today's date, June 15th. Again, the subject of today's class is Nature's Religion. It's very evocative teaching by Moshe, I believe. Let's see what you all think. But this relates to it, interestingly enough, as the universe does often. Provide synchronicity. Pray to your hand. The foundation for insanity is laid, and every moment it increases as the universe expands. Too convincing for most is form, to then not call it real. Too convincing for most is form, to then not call it real, and to not then be its wholehearted servant at times. Some balance, dear, some delicate discernment is required between what appears to be and what really is not. Let it often come down to this. For the right equation, you need to solve the big dilemma. It's just too vast for most. Yes, let it come down to this. When thoughts and aspects of the infinite can no longer delight you. When thoughts and aspects of the infinite can no longer delight you. Pray to your hand that it reveals all the wonder you will ever need to be satisfied. For it is there, the divine mystery is in all things. And so we shall see with this teaching what Moshe also reveals about this. So the title of this lesson is, Moshe gave it the title, Hazara Nikon, Nature's Religion. And this is from the text, In the Eastern Rose Garden. It's a long text, so I have edited it, but on the website I'll put a link to the complete text, and I'll paraphrase along the way. As a reminder, I wanted to just review a couple statements from the last class we had here, and that was on the God ideal. And there are two quotes that stood out, and I thought I would read them just to kind of get us back in sync with this line of teachings. We took that break at camp and had an entirely different subject. But this is on the God ideal, again, by Hosward and Knight Kahn. And he says this: the God ideal is the flower of creation. The God ideal is the flower of creation, and the realization of truth is its fragrance. And the realization of truth is its fragrance. Again, it's going to relate very much to what we're talking about today. So I thought it was important to go back, take a little step back. The last line of this teaching from the I think it was May, says this: if we follow the natural religion, that divine impulse that is in every heart, then we shall be living the true religion. Again, if we follow the natural religion, that divine impulse that is in every heart, then we shall be living the true religion. From this teaching on nature's religion, Mercia teaches us this. Religion may begin in the East or in the West, in the South or the North, yet it will always, in the end, be many religions. The more you ponder upon how all can come from one, the plainer becomes the fact that all expressions are of the one religion. And this religion is nature's religion. Now here Mercia in the paper, I'll paraphrase, talks about this. That how when people looked at a stone, or maybe stones that make a mountain or hill, they thought, this is so strong, it's more mighty than I. And they began to worship it. And the stone could be broken, and they thought, what's this? There must be something more than that. And they began to worship trees, reaching towards the heavens. And then too, the trees died. So they said, there must be something more than this. So they began to look at the stars. But the stars come and go with the night sky. So they thought, mightier than the stars are the sun. It obliterates the stars. But then, too, it appears the sun came and went. So the search went on and on and on. And so then Mercia goes on in this paper and says, the question as to what exactly this religion really is and how one may get to know it can only be answered by those who have raised themselves beyond the limitations of ceremony and dogma in which they were always first instructed. So here he's telling us, we've all, most of us, were raised in a certain faith, but how do we raise ourselves above that and not be constricted by it? How can one take a larger view, a view that perhaps encompasses all the horizon and all the religions? This, of course, he teaches us in the Universal Worship Service, as well as many other things. The text titled The Unity of Religious Ideals is a beautiful one to turn to for more on that subject. Again, Mercia says, the question as to what exactly this religion really is and how one may get to know it can only be answered by those who have raised themselves beyond the limitations of ceremony and dogma in which they are first instructed. But rising above religion does not mean giving up the religion. Oh, I used to be a whatever, and now I'm a whatever. It means being fully benefited by the religion. Those who say they've given up their religion are not above it. Those alone are above it who have arrived at a full understanding of the spirit of religion. The spirit of religion. Perhaps not even one particular religion, but the spirit of religion. As soon as the spirit of religion has become manifest, then indeed the eyes are blessed. One could also say that the whole senses are blessed, but here Murshid only says the eyes. The distinctions and differences of castes and creeds and religions may vanish away in one moment of time. And one begins to perhaps see these various prophets, these various religions, as beads on a mala that have gotten strung one by one throughout time and yet are connected through the center, through the heart, through the soul. My words, not Murshid's. His last sentence here was, the distinctions and differences of caste and creeds and religions all vanish away in one moment. Why is this so important? Always try to remember where Murshid was raised, what was the cultural context, and what was the societal environment at the time. We were just coming upon this awakening of India, starting to think about independence. There were a lot of gurus. There still are. There's so many religions in India, perhaps more religions that are celebrated than maybe any other country on earth, maybe USA, because we've embraced a lot of those religions as well. But nonetheless, India was always very accepting. Of course, in the end, religion came to separate people. We know that through the revolution and the partitioning of Pakistan. But at any rate, Murshid is looking at this because also in India, there's a caste system. There are these creeds and there are different religions. And Murshid from the beginning had this very unitive outlook. Even people in his circle were critical. Some of the murids would run to his Murshid and say, oh, Anayat, he doesn't pray like us, or he sings songs to Hindu gods. He doesn't dress like us. He doesn't follow these restrictions. And the Murshid said, those are not for him. Those are not for him. So he had this view. And he lived in a household where the religions were embraced. He learned English at a young age, so on and so forth. So he goes on to say here, Murshid, when one studies nature, one finds that nature cannot create itself without expressing its religion. What an interesting phrase. When one studies nature, one finds that nature cannot create itself without expressing its religion. I think that relates back to this phrase. The God ideal is in the flower of creation, and the realization is of the truth is in the fragrance. The sitar of all these different things mixed together. But does that not seem a little bit like a koan to anyone else? When one studies nature, one finds that nature cannot create itself without expressing its religion. We can come back to it, and I'll highlight it in the PDF for you to continue to think about it. The origin of all religion is love and beauty. Love and beauty. If there were no love or beauty, religion would never have existed, because beauty is the beginning of worship and prayer. And if one thinks about this, we've always seen, you know, historically or read about accounts of these places where people gathered for worship, and of course the churches were and still are in many ways the most magnificent buildings. Even in the poorest of countries, you see these incredibly beautiful, lots of people giving little money to make these beautiful places of worship, these houses of worship. And you know, when Joe and I were in Thailand, I said to him, jokingly, first of all, it was a little hot when we were there and in Cambodia. And the one sort of shining bright place everywhere we went was a 7-Eleven. And it was always air conditioned. But the other bright shining place, every place, were these beautiful temples. And the way they were made, they didn't require air conditioning because they're built and oriented so they catch the winds and the way the breeze goes through and they're open. It was so refreshing. Of course, lots of trees around and, you know, and these beautiful buildings, but also the courtyards, you know, just, you can't help but feel inspired, you know, just by the architecture and then, of course, the beautiful nature that's incorporated, even if in the middle of the city, and the statues, you just feel uplifted. So don't find that so much in some of the more modern churches, but certainly in the older, more established churches or those that model themselves after them. So this idea of beauty and this idea of love, certainly we see this also in the Buddhist temples in India. In all the temples, actually, beautiful Baha'i temple, like a lotus in Delhi. So this is this idea of beauty. And then Murshid goes on to say, if there were no love or beauty, religion would never have existed because beauty is the beginning of worship and prayer. The beginning of prayer and the first step of worship is admiration. So perhaps it's like when we first encountered the teachings of Jesus or the teachings of Murshid. We began to admire his outlook and we had a feeling like someone understands my heart and my soul, and it drew us in, you know. And all of course the master and saints and prophets have the exact same spirit of guidance running through them. So Murshid is trying to get us to see this unitive aspect of all religion and worship and admiration for something that is perhaps higher than us in the sense that it uplifts us, that it gives us the sense to want to strive. And then Murshid says, prayer and worship are acts of bowing to beauty. Acts necessary to satisfy the predisposition with which every soul is born. And then he says that that predisposition is called love. I think love is a moving scale. You know, what does that mean? If we asked each one of you, those online, we'd find everyone would have a different idea of what that love is. And from day to day, it may change. But in the sense of, you know, when we think of these great prophets, or even the modern day saints and prophets, you know, the sacrifices that they make. They leave their home of comfort, they travel a lot, they're not on their own schedule, and they're giving tirelessly to other beings, just giving, giving, giving. Many of you do that in your own way through your work, in your community. That's love. It's a love with a kind of independence and indifference without expectation of return, but it's the thing to do. So it's having that equanimity. And here nature teaches us that. Because when the sun shines everywhere and doesn't make a distinction. So this is a kind of love filled with equanimity. And I thought, I don't think that our Nirid circle has worked with this Lazipa, but I've been working with it since I've been concentrating on this class, and I'd like to introduce it to you. And the sacred name is Wadud. Wadud. W, it's sometimes spelled W-A-D-U-D or W-A-H-D-O-O-D. Wadud. And Wadud is love, divine love. And it has many dimensions, and I thought I'd share a few of these with you. And then we'll do the practice. So Wadud is divine love's most intimate manifestation. And that's called Sharif, Sharifa, Sharifa, Safir. Each one of you are the most intimate manifestation. You are both God's love and an expression of God's love. It is the constant embrace of an affectionate, loving universe. I think it's good to pause and think, do we think of the universe as being, or the world, if we want to say that, as being kind and loving to us? We may not, and yet, if we could only look at the universe in our hands, like Hafiz said, my God, how incredible is that just this works every day, that it allows us to reach out to someone, that it allows us to receive, that it allows us to toil for our work, that it allows us to feed ourselves. This in and of itself is an incredible act of manifested love. Yawadud is the antidote for all who have difficulty achieving intimacy with others. Sometimes, you know, there's a lot of textbooks on this, a lot of writing on the fear of intimacy, the fear that one may lose oneself, the fear that one may become absorbed by another, the fear that one may be overcome, the fear that one could be open and hurt. There's a lot of reasons why one might fear that intimacy. Well, guess what? It's all going to come anyway. You might as well just love. It's all coming. The lessons are going to be there, whether or not we try to avert them. We're going to have our heart broken. We're going to be taken to the high heavens. I'm going to be thrown to ground. We're going to be disappointed. It's part of life. But Merchant has some insight later in this paper for us about that. So Wadud also offers us an avenue for seeing divine love in challenging situations and in difficulties. It consciously uses the densest elements of a situation as an inner impetus to turn to God. When you feel really broken, oh God, please help me, right? Here's an interesting, I'll make it personal. So I was visiting a friend. She was one of the senior Sufis in the Sufi order at the time. And her name was Arifa Miller. She was really a wonderful human being. She wasn't always very easy because she was quite to the point. Some of you met her. She came to town when we were working on the Alchemical Wisdom Project from Pure Life. And so she was a no-nonsense person. She had been a real estate agent in Woodstock, New York. She'd also been a dancer and studied with Ruth St. Denis. So, you know, when she went way back. So she was in her 80s when I met her. And I remember one day I was visiting, it was prior to one of the retreats with Pure Goliath. She lived at the abode, I was staying with her. And so I was kvetching about something, you know, like complaining about something in my life. And she's driving and she looks over at me like this. And she said, Nuria, what do you think God's trying to teach you through that experience? What a good way, you know, like, what am I trying to learn from this difficult situation? It changed things. It just helped me look at those things in that way. You know, am I learning to be more compassionate, more understanding, more accepting, you know, less disappointed, setting, you know, I mean, what are those things? So when those difficulties arise, when those challenges arise, always ask. Because I have found that God first knocks gently at the door. And if I don't get it, then I get a little shove. And then if I don't get it, I might get a slap. And if I don't get it, I'm going to get that big old stick out until I listen. So what is that lesson? It's between you and God. Past is past. Teacher hasn't arisen. Right here, right now. Y'all won't do it. Does that help?
explain what you? It's my explanation, but perhaps it's so. I'm going to take my beads off if I can wrangle them off my wrist. And we're going to say Yah Wadud aloud. And let's intone it the first 11 times. And then we'll continue for 34 times. Yah Wadud aloud. And then we'll whisper. And we'll breathe in. And then out. Wadud. So this receiving and giving of God's love. And while the recitation is going on, we invoke this presence of divine love that we can call upon in all situations in life. And then when we go into the silent breath of Wadud for the last 33, we feel the subtle quality arising and circulating from within. We allow it to become more intimate within our being. And also with the N, let yourself do the D, not just Wadud. Like it's almost like putting that the dot at the end of the statement. Wadud. From the collarbone down to the belly button, that long, and then do rises. It's kind of to the throat. So when we think about it, this we're kind of striking this drum, invoking this sound, and allowing it to rise so that we may give expression or experience the spirit of this sacred name. And we'll continue. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, remember to ask, what lesson is God's love giving to me? Merchant's words, again from Nature's Religion. The Bible tells us to raise our light on high, but it is covered under a bushel. The bushel is the manifested part of our life. All these forms that cover the inner intelligence, which in its original aspect is the root of being, and it's this bushel. The inner intelligence, the light, has become veiled under the manifestation. And it is the desire of nature to unfold it again. The inner intelligence, the light, has become veiled under the manifestation, and it is the desire of nature to unfold it again, so as to allow it to behold its original being, which it does through all stages that take the form of death and destruction. Okay, very interesting, isn't it? Again, for me, I have studied Murshid as all of you have for so many years. This teaching is extremely profound and is a bit of a mystery for us to unwind. So, the inner intelligence, the light, has become veiled under manifestation. We can get that. You know, we understand that through our learning and our complexities and our desires, you know, we get, the light can become obscured. And Murshid gives us that example of like a lantern whose shade has become dusty, or a mirror whose reflection is obscured from something being thrown over it. What happens if we take that off? So that's what we're trying to do. The inner intelligence, the light, has become veiled by manifestation, and it is the desire of nature to unfold it again. Again, one could say that's a kind of unlearning, the be ye as little children. It's
the no mind, don't know. It's having an inquisitive nature, the what if, all possibilities. But I think it's also this channel, and there's a text called The Phenomena of the Soul, and Mershad gives us a clue there where he talks about the sun as that divine being, and the rays of the sun are each one of us coming into manifestation. And he says that we can use the breath as a lift, that we often think of God as being at one pole and we are at the other pole, but really there is always that connection, that thread. It's a matter of where our perspective is. Where are we choosing to be on that line? That thread is always there. And he said, I think the exact word he gives is use the breath like a lift, like an elevator, to elevate one's consciousness and feel that divine connection. So it is the desire of nature to unfold it, this divine intelligence, this inner intelligence, again, so as to allow it to behold its original form, which it does through all changes that take the form of death and destruction. What does that mean?
Forged by fire.
Forged by fire, the phoenix rising out of the ashes. The Sufi dies before death. And that's you could repeat that every day and concentrate on just that alone. I think you can get realization. Die before death. Dying to the small self, constantly resurrecting again to the unborn, unmanifested, never-ending, divine inner intelligence, that impulse.
What's Rumi say? Only death dies.
Yeah, Mershad says that too. Mershad quotes him saying,
I think of that line from the poem Love Dogs, the grief you call out from or cry out from draws you towards you.
Yeah. And we see that as an endless cycle in nature, of course. I was talking with someone that it had never occurred to me what the snow does for the trees. Here we see that often the snow is so heavy and so laden, accompanied by ice, that it breaks our trees. But I was talking with someone who lives in the north, and they said because they didn't have much snowfall this year, it's like a blanket that protects the trees from the sun, and we also know it gives moisture. But because it didn't have this blanket of protection, the trees are all brown, because there was too much sunlight on them. It's very interesting to think about that. I'm trying to recall, I was watching something, it was a something in nature the other day, and I thought, what is the intelligence in that being that makes it understand and know that it has to do this thing, and I can't remember now. But during the class off, but just observing, it's like that inner intelligence. Just observing is so revelatory. But this idea, you know, of death and destruction, but again, die before death. Small self, it's that fauna, that surrender, and baka, resurrection. So I thought we might work with another practice that could highlight this idea of this inner light, this inner intelligence, this inner luminosity, and also this aspect of God that's never ending and never dies. So we'll do them in tandem. First one, the sacred name is Yanur. and many of you are familiar with it, but it's this inner light, this inner luminosity, this sort of self-enlightening awareness. And it is the light that is inherent in every soul. And what's more, it's in every pore of our being, is this divine, you know, intelligence pulsing and dancing. It's enlightenment itself. Through God's grace, may we get a glimpse of that. And then Al-Qayyum. Qayyum is the sacred name that transcends the passage of time. Things come and things go, and Qayyum remains. It's this eternal life. All things continually exist, even after death. It is said that these are living entities in the mind of God, in the consciousness of God, in the light of God. And Murshid says this: it is our perception of time which passes, not time itself. It is our perception of time which passes, not time itself. For time is God, and God is eternal. So one could take great comfort in that, that knowing that these moments, these thoughts, these experiences are also in the eternal, but they're in the temporal as well. And getting a glimpse of that eternal can give one comfort in challenging times. When my mother was quite ill and on the verge of passing, I used Yahai, which is Olai, and Qayyum, Qayyum, eternal life, to assist in her passage and also to aid in my understanding of that passage. It was very helpful. Life lives, it never dies, it is eternal in some form. In all forms, one can say. So would you like to try this practice together? And let's just do this for we're doing okay on time. Let me see how much time we have. But let's just maybe do this practice 11 times toning, and then 11 times whispering, and 11 times silent. Light of intelligence. Eternal existence. From beginningless time to endless time. Ever expanding. Ever in the moment. Just on the breath. Breathing in, enlivening this inner intelligence, and sending it out into this ever-living, unceasing universe. Again, in Mershon's words, nature teaches every soul to worship God in some way or other, and often provides that which is suitable for each. So it is too with the manner of worship. It does not matter in what way a person offers respect and reverence to the deity one worships. It only matters how sincere a person is in their offering. So where is one's mind? Where is one's heart? Where's one's devotion? A friend of mine from Tibet said his brother, who was a monk, went into a three-year private retreat. And all he could think about was how to raise enough money to build his family a house, his parents. So he went back for another 3 years because he realized he wasn't concentrated on his practice. His mind was here and there and, you know, contriving and conniving. And so, you know, how does one keep that deep devotion? Focus. For me, it's the only cure. Whatever ails one. It's the answer. It's the antidote. It's the medicine. It's the upliftment. It only matters how sincere a person is in their offering. On the other hand, I remember hearing a mom, Balahai, say, I always do my practices at the same time every day. Of course, you know, Mershin has described these times for us. It's not often doable. I myself, if I find I've like missed the noon, you know, the 11:55 prayer, I, in my mind, I wind the clock back later in the day and imagine that I'm there and the sun is at a certain position and I'm saying the prayers. I think it's just important to have the devotion to say them. But at any rate, he said I did, you know, he had had the ability in his life, at least at that time, to have the discipline to say them. And he said, I have to say, it's a great biofeedback machine for me, or biofeedback system. Because I can look every day at myself at that time, and I can check the condition, my inner condition. And he says, you know, sometimes it's not so good. And sometimes it's great and I'm really focused. But that regularity gives me insight. And Rashida Vira used to, I remember for at least the first 3 months of my being with her, she said to do this and you might think about it because it can give some insight. I did it for 3 months. She said, have a calendar. And when you feel it's been a good day, put a plus sign. And when you feel it's been a bad day, put a minus sign. And when you feel it's just been neutral, put a zero. And she said, then look and see if you can start to track that. Because in being able to do that, one can anticipate. Oh, maybe I know that I've got a little rhythm here and maybe I take a little dip. You know, it could be brain chemistry, body chemistry, hormonal chemistry, but it helps us to see that and anticipate it. We can be a master of our fate. We can grab a hold of ourselves and say, I maybe need a little something different, or you need to be aware of this today. You might try it as a practice, do a 3-month calendar. It's very insightful. You start to see these patterns that one goes through. Mershid goes on to say, the secret of all is found in the answer to this question. Why are we here? The answer is that one is here to attain the satisfaction of one's innermost desire. The answer is that one is here to attain the satisfaction of one's innermost desire. And then he says, and what is that innermost desire? Do we know? Can we say? Well, Mershid tells us. It is first joy and then peace. First joy and then peace. So a little bit, joy can give you a feeling of excitation. And peace can give you a feeling of relaxation. Now here's another secret. Turn to that teaching on mystic relaxation by Mershid, because he talks about the benefits of activity and repose and the balance of the two. That we are often in a world where there's two, or we are involved in too much activity, which Mershid will say in a minute, I'll read it in his own words, is actually the thing that can give joy. But there must also be a balance, a time to absorb and find peace. One without the other is not necessarily what we're striving for, but this balance. And when we talked about that teaching, we talked, you know, in my own mind, I remember times like graduate school. And I was so busy, I thought, my God, I'm hardly sleeping. I hardly have time to eat. All I'm doing is working, working, working. But then I knew that I could just get my mind a little bit ahead and knowing, okay, I'm doing this right now, and when I'm a little bit further ahead, I will have some time. Just even that thought, that you know you're going to have that repose, is helpful. And sometimes it's working really hard. It's like exercise. Now we know that with exercise. What is that called? High intensity something. High intensity workouts. Yeah. So you work real hard, and then you relax your muscles. And then you work real, that there's more benefit than just sort of an even keel. So sometimes you need these, this excitation, relaxation, this exaltation. I don't know what the opposite is. Earthing is groundedness. So he says, the secret is to be found in the answer. And he says the answer is first joy, then peace. And then he says, but the attainment of each is contrary. So again, joy may be bubbly and exciting and maybe extroverted and, you know, it may be an expression. It can also be an inner state for sure that doesn't need expression. But he says, because joy becomes the activity of life, peace comes from rest. Peace comes from rest. But then he has a sense of humor because he says, all this activity that a person experiences, enjoys by the senses, is a glimpse of joy. It's just a glimpse. This isn't it. You get a glimpse. The greatest joy comes when we can experience through the, now get this, I made this bold because I thought, I've not even ever heard him use that word again. Then I went through other teachings. He calls the tuner, T-U-N-E-R, self, S-E-L-F, the tuner self. And when I looked up that phrase in his other teachings, it relates to the relationship one has with one's teacher. Hmm. And tuning oneself to that pitch. Or tuning to that pitch of God. So the tuner self, so we can think about tuning this instrument, the tuner self. So he says, and that can come through the mind. So we have to think about it, be conscious of it, grab it, do it deliberately and consciously. And then he says, for there is another joy, that of the mind, when it is delighted with a thing of truth, of delicacy, or a beautiful thought, or a butterfly. My sister will get the joke. But he says also beautiful music. Of course, Mershit was a musician. And he says, a beautiful verse. And he says, a beautiful imagination, a creative mind that's inspired. These all bring delight. It is perhaps a greater joy than the joy of a delicious dish. He says, I think that's interesting that he would say that. There's a lot of importance put on food on so many cultures, Indian culture being one of them. But he says, it is perhaps a greater joy than the joy of a delicious dish. It sounds funny. It is a little funny, but it's also very revealing. There's something hidden underneath that. A delicious dish. For some persons would give anything for a verse, which they would never give for a delicious dish. So think about what he's saying. This delicious verse, this delightful verse versus a delicious dish. Why?
Lasts a lot longer.
That's exactly right. One is in and out.
Feeding something else.
And we're feeding the soul. That's right. That's right. Very good. Good student. Good teachers. Hadayat said to me when Mershit Hadayat, an icon, one day we were in the back room at the summer school. It was always kind of this room where people would go for some repose. And I think I had just given a talk or sermon at Universal Worship. And he was also a person that was quite exuberant, you know, expressive. Perhaps you've seen some of his videos online, and he said, my father always said, the Murid makes the Mershit. Again, it's the tuner self. What are we tuning to? And having people around us in community that are tuning to those things and can lift us up, one can say, who's the student and who's the teacher? We're all students and we're all teachers. Then Merchant says, joy is experienced by worldly attainment. Peace is attained, the attainment of heaven. Joy is experienced by worldly attainment. Peace is the attainment of heaven. In the ordinary sense, we call it peace to be at rest in an armchair, or on a cushion, or in bed. And then he says, but when the body is on a comfortable couch, does that mean that the mind is resting on the cushion as well? You know, the minute you sit down, I don't know about you all, but it's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and take a breather. The phone rings. I'm going to sit down and take the breather. Or someone's doing their weed whacker. You know, but it's like, can I find that inside that sound? You know? Kamtul Rinpoche, we said, hear all sounds as the manifestation of the deity's mantra. When you do that, it changes. Not the jackhammer. It's, oh, money, bye, bye, oh, money, bye, you know? So, I mean, it can be. We can make it into that. But when the body is on a comfortable couch, does it mean that the mind is resting on the cushion also? Cannot the mind go through torture at the same time? Sometimes more so, because if we're not active, we're more aware, sometimes more aware of the mind. That's why Sogyal Rinpoche always says, the greatest protection of the mind is the mantra. Use your practices. They're a seal on that monkey mind. They give something productive and a productive impression. If we're going to make lines in the mind, let's make a groove for the practice, not a groove for, you know, X, Y, and Z, whatever, you know, because we tend to do that, you know. Gemini muse, because you know, former professor, still professor, and Joe, we've also talked about that. Anyone that's gotten an evaluation at work, we have the opportunity to get 18 of them in 3 classes. So, you know, and it can be 100 great ones, and there's one that says a little something, and it's that one thing. I wonder why they said that. I wonder what that was. I wonder what I did. You know what I mean?
Oh,
you know, I'll place it with another thought. Erase it with the sacred word. So again, can the mind not go through torture at the same time when we're trying to be peaceful? The mind must have peace from anxieties, worry, and from the greed that gives us ambitious desires. When all this is gone, the mind is at rest. Just putting it down, putting it down, putting it down. Sometimes acceptance. What is it that Swami Ji says, Mudita, about acceptance?
Puja Swami Ji or Mahatma Ji?
Puja Swami Ji.
Accept,
don't expect. Doesn't he say that? Accept, don't expect.
Oh, yeah. No.
Expectations are the mother of disappointment.
Yes.
Expectations
are
the mother of disappointment, of all disappointment. That's a great little phrase. It's true. Well, right. And you know, he was also, he does this interesting thing with words. He's a master, or really universalist, but more in the maybe Hindu orientation, who lives in Rishikesh, where Cecily Mudita goes and visits. And he takes these phrases, they're like a little phrase that just keeps working and working on you. And so like one of them is, well, I know when he was giving a talk, we were together in the Netherlands, and it was on, he said, are we filling the shelf or the self? That was a good one. Are we filling the shelf or the self? It relates to this.
And he always says, instead of a gift for an anniversary or birthday, plant a tree.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's just something for the such.
For the shell.
It's dust. But if anyone's interested in finding
yes.
him on YouTube, A Day in the Light.
A Day in the Light.
A Day in the Light. It's a very short 30-minute video, and he has some of those ditties.
Those beautiful sayings.
Mm-hmm. A Day in the Light.
And then that will get you to other videos as well. So he's doing many, many good works in the world there.
Mm-hmm.
They've cleaned up. I remember being at the Ganges. It was so muddy. And so, like, we remember we were there,
mm-hmm.
and we were going out for boat rides, and they said, do not get anything on you, in your mouth, in your nose, whatever. You know, it's like, put Vaseline, don't, anyone remember? It was like this whole, and now, because of the work that Pujaswami Ji and his disciples and these projects that he has going, it's like aqua blue, you can see to the, nature does prepare itself.
I swim in it daily.
She swims, and my sister swims in it when she's there. This is the miracle of, you know, and he's praying, but he's doing too.
Mm-hmm.
Praying and doing, you know, and practical. Like, people need toilet facilities. They're showing people how to build these so it's not all going into the river. And washing facilities, and planting the trees, and picking up the plastic bags, and teaching people how to do this. You know, this is a great master, selfless service. He has a female counterpart. Satviji, she's also doing her great part, raising women up.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful what they're doing and how they're inspiring the world. So Mersha then closes in this way. When we can go through this, and I'm going to paraphrase, this idea of joy and of peace, keep these in our minds, of joy and peace. And you can also work with that practice. We can do it before we close. Salam. Salam is great peace, deep peace. And then you can awake to the religion of nature, which is the only religion. And the more we understand it, the greater our life becomes. And the more a blessing will our life be for others. So in the end, what do you think Mersha's talking about in terms of nature? What nature?
Our nature,
human nature. And Mersha talks about this in the text that talks about the realms or levels of manifestation, that we go from the mineral kingdom. Rishi Nibiru was a great master of this as well. We go from the mineral kingdom, think about it, solid, doesn't move of its own volition. Then we go to the plant kingdom. There's movement, there's involvement. I mean, we know that over time, of course, the earth is also evolving or devolving, whatever the case may be right now. We pray and do our part there. The plants have their own cycles. They have an appearance, at least to us, of being in a cycle of life, and death, and rebirth. Then the animal kingdom. And then, he says, from the animal kingdom, Rashida Vera would say to us, oh, look at that rock. Do you see a something in it? You know, this is why the Sufis love amber, because the animals or the insects are caught in it, or pieces of the plant world or the vegetation world. You know, you see little ferns and stuff in amber. It has a lot of magnetism because it's captured these things. Then, so mineral kingdom, the rocks, the plant kingdom, then the animal kingdom, and then the highest, although I question it sometimes, is the human realm. This is the most living expression of God on earth. And then there are other realms that are unseen. But that gives us the great privilege, but perhaps one could also say the great responsibility to do as Merchant says here. Then we awake to the religion of nature, which is the only religion. And the more we understand it, the greater our life becomes, and the more of a blessing will our life be for others. So when we encounter others, are we blessing them? Do we get that sense of blessing? I bless you, God. But you know what I'm saying. I mean, does our atmosphere, doesn't even have to be anything we say or do. What does our atmosphere say? What are we cultivating as our inner nature? That's a very important question. We almost have to tell our, or be willing to look at the naked truth of ourselves and unmask it to get to who we really are. Andrew Harvey. Some of you might know his name. He's written books on sort of translations and commentary on Rumi, but he talks about the need to burn the scaffolding down, or the house of cards. We could call it our authentic self. Are we being our authentic self? So you need to ask these questions and be honest. Are we living to that higher purpose? You know? Let's do. Now that we do Alhamdulillah. Like all praise to God, but it's also this feeling of, can you find a feeling of joy? Because it's very uplifting. It's also interesting, it could be like Alleluia. Yeah. Ooh, all those sounds are in this one sacred thing. And then we could, so that's the joy. And then we could use Ya Salam, the peace. So we have them both. We'll do it 11 times. And then I think our class time has come to a close. And I do want, I'm offering all those that have joined us virtually some tea and cookies and snacks, and all of you in the room, I'm offering them to you quite literally. And if anyone wants to stay online for conversation afterwards, we'll be here. We can talk to each other more and exchange and meet each other in that way. I do know some people have other appointments, they told me, as they come, or you may have work or something to get to from online. We understand that. I just want to make things available. You can unmute your microphones and we can have exchange or question and answer. We'll be moving about as people get their tea, but we can also bring chairs here to meet together. So, Alhamdulillah. Yes.
Alhamdulillah. Ya Salam. 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 Alhamdulillah. Ya Salam.
We'll close as we began with a prayer.
And we, before that closing prayer, we ask that if anything here has been of merit or benefit, may it, like a stone dropped in a pond, send in every and ever widening circles joy and peace and love. May all beings come to know their true inner nature and the purpose for which they were given birth and the attainment of that, which is different and unique as the rays of the sun are. But it takes each one playing its own note for the symphony to have a beautiful sound. Each instrument is important and contributes. And I put a link out on Facebook for contributions. I see some people have already contributed. Thank you so much. And we all have a donate button on the webpage to make a contribution. It helps to defray the expenses for all of this that makes the teachings available. And as we began, let us close with palms up in receptivity to divine impulses that are pulsing and moving and alive within each being. And we close with the Sufi prayer by Sufi Inayat Khan, Khatun. Oh, thou.
Wow. Who are the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth. Open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly comes from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness, teach us thy loving forgiveness, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide, send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being.
And use this cup of blessing to flow through you and all around.